Good morning and welcome to Mornings for the Master here on the Gospel Radio Network. I'm your host this morning, Ryan Smithy, and as always, we are so thankful that you are able to join us, that together we can study through the Bible as once again we continue our march in our study through the Old Testament. Just a few moments, we'll be in 1 Kings chapter 20 as we wrap up this book today, 1 Kings chapter 20 through verse 22. Going to be looking at Ahab and Naboth's vineyard. And so we'll be looking at a few of those events here in just a moment. But I want to remind you, we have a busy weekend once again ahead of us. There is a lot that is going on, and certainly hope that you can take advantage of each of these opportunities that you can. For one, there's a special presentation, if you will, going on this weekend at the Youngsport Congregation in Killeen, Texas. Brian Hodge is the preacher there, and here he is with a special invitation to that meeting.
Hi, this is Brian Hodge with the Youngsport Church of Christ in Killeen, Texas. I would like to invite you to a special event that we are hosting April 20th through the 23rd. We will host U.S. Army Colonel Ricky N. Hagen, will bring us a conversation about PTSD and TBI. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7 p.m. Sunday at 10 and 11 a.m. For more information, see our website, churchofchristyoungsport.org, or our Facebook event, A Conversation About PTSD and TBI with Colonel Ricky N. Hagen. For more information, you can call me, Brian Hodge, at 903-578-7489, or email me at brian.hodge@ymail.com. Hope to see you there.
All right, and so once again, that is Thursday night through Sunday, if you have opportunity to be with the Youngsport congregation. Also, this Friday night through Sunday, April 21st through 23rd, are the Lovelady Lectures in Lovelady, Texas. Once again, looking at lessons in lyrics. And the same weekend, April 21st through 23rd, are the Maybank Lectures, looking this year at Convicted. And so two great opportunities here in East Texas. If you can make it out to Lovelady, if you can make it out to Maybank, or possibly you can make it also down, if you're down closer to the Austin area, make it out to the Killeen area for that special presentation on PTSD. Then beginning Sunday, there is a gospel meeting at the Kettle Mills Church of Christ, and they are going to be looking at commonly asked Bible questions and being able to answer those. Pat McIntosh will be preaching there on Sunday. Monday night, Carl McCann. Tuesday night, Richard Stevens. And Wednesday night, Bruce Smith. And so hope that you can make it out to Caddo Mills. If you're in that Greenville area, East Dallas area, hope that you can be out with them. Looking forward, mark your calendar, April 30th through May the 3rd, gospel meeting at the Mineola Church of Christ in Mineola, Texas. They are having John Ratliff will be the speaker, and they are going to be looking at the theme or the lessons, the bottom line, in pursuit of maturity, measuring maturity part one, measuring maturity part two, how do you measure up, and spiritual maturity. And so hope that you will be able to make it out for that as they look at that idea of spiritual maturity. And then a gospel meeting May 18th through 21st, The Church Jesus Built, and that's going to be at the East Mountain Church of Christ out in the Tyler area in Gilmer, more precisely. And so hope that you can be out for those events. And so a lot that is going on. As always, the spring is a very busy time of year. But those are a few things that we want to put before you and remind you that are coming up. Let us now turn our attention to 1 Kings as we once again are looking at 1 Kings chapter 20. Now, we've already been introduced to Ahab, and certainly that is a name that draws familiarity. We know about his works. We know about his wife Jezebel, who urged him on in those works as well. She was certainly a great part of the wickedness that occurred in the reign of Ahab. And so we continue to see these things in his life as we turn once again now to 1 Kings chapter 20. In 1 Kings chapter 20, we once again see the wickedness, but also I think the weakness of Ahab. Here is a king that has trusted in himself. And as long as he trusts in himself, he's going to fail. He's going to show the weakness that he has. And so in 1 Kings chapter 20, we have an occasion where Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, is gathering together his army, and he is going to march against Israel. And his demand is going to be to send out your wives, send out your children, send out your money. And he agrees to this. Let's begin reading in verse 1. And Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, gathered all of his hosts together, and there were 32 kings with him, and horses and chariots, and he went up and besieged Samaria and warred against it. And he sent messengers to Ahab, king of Israel, into the city, and he said, "Thus saith Ben-Hadad, thy silver and thy gold is mine. Thy wives also and thy children, even the goodliest, are mine." And the king of Israel answered and said, "My lord, O king, according to thy saying, I am thine and all that I have." You see there his weakness. He knows that he is outnumbered. He knows that he is outmatched. And so he is ready to give in to the king's to Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, and those that are with him. We continue reading there. The messengers, verse 5, came again and said, "Thus speaks Ben-Hadad, saying, although I have sent unto thee, saying, thou shalt deliver me thy silver and thy gold and thy wives and thy children, yet I will send my servants unto thee tomorrow about this time, and they shall search your house and the houses of your servants. It shall be whatsoever is pleasant in thine eyes. Thou shalt put it in their hand and take it away." Now it's too much. Now the king of Syria is changing his terms. Now Ahab has had too much. He said, "I can't agree to this." You continue in that section down through verse 12. He's going to gather his advisors together, the elders. He said, "Look at what this man is doing. He's already asked for all of these things, and I didn't deny him. But now he's asking too much." And the elders will tell him, "Don't listen to him. Don't hearken unto him. Don't agree with what he is asking." And so now, as that word is taken to Ben-Hadad, verse 10, Ben-Hadad will return and say, "The gods do so unto me, and more also, if the dust of Samaria shall suffice for handfuls for all the people that follow me." In other words, he's boasting. "You're going to be destroyed because you have denied my request." Ahab now will shoot back, if you will, in verse 11, and answered and said, "Let not him that girdeth on his harness boast himself as he that putteth it off." Now Ahab is speaking here with what we might call a big head. There are 32 kings that have gathered together with Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, outside of Ahab's walls. And Ahab is basically saying, if you want war, that's fine. But don't boast yourself before time. In other words, it's one thing to strap on the sword and go to war, but there's one of us that's going to go home and take that sword off again. And so he is even, if you will, goading him on. But what I love here is God is going to take this situation. Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, and Ahab, king of Israel, both know one thing. Israel is outnumbered. Israel is outmatched. And they are likely to lose this war. But God is going to use this opportunity to show his power. Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, and those kings that are with him are going to see the power of God. But not only that, Ahab is going to see the power of God. He's going to be reminded, you can't fight this war, but I can fight it for you. If you would turn to me, I would be for you. And so God is going to show him that great power. In verse 13 through verse 21 of this chapter, we begin to get this pronouncement. There was a prophet, verse 13, that came unto Ahab, king of Israel, saying, thus saith the Lord, hast thou seen all this great multitude? Look at the army that is stretched out before you. And the prophet says, from the mouth of God, behold, I will deliver it into thine hand this day, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord. There's the power behind this force. It's God that's going to be fighting for you. Ahab, you can't do it, but God can do it. And so you're going to see the power, and you're going to see the majesty of God as he goes forth and he fights for you. And Ahab asked, by whom? How's this going to be accomplished? The prophet said, thus saith the Lord, even by the young men of the princes of the provinces. Then he said, who shall order the battle? And he answered, thou, Ahab, you're going to lead them. You gather your forces and go out to war. And we have to give Ahab credit. He prepares for this battle. Verse 15, he numbers the young men of the princes of the provinces. They were 232. Remember, Ben-Hadad's outside the city with an army that includes 32 kings that are with him. This is going to be a relatively small number that Ahab is gathering together, because now he also numbers all the people, even all the children of Israel, being 7,000. Verse 16, they went out at noon, and Ben-Hadad was drinking himself drunk in the pavilions, he and the kings and the 32 kings that helped him. And the young men of the princes of the provinces went out first, and Ben-Hadad sent out, and they told him, saying, there are men come out of Samaria. And he said, whether they come for peace, take them alive, or whether they come out for war, take them alive. So these young men of the princes of the provinces came out of the city and the army which followed them, and they slew every one his man. And the Syrians fled, and Israel pursued them. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, escaped on a horse with the horsemen, and the king of Israel went out and smote the horses and chariots and slew the Syrians with a great slaughter. Now, in the eyes of man and in military understanding, this should not have happened. Syria should never have been defeated, but they were, because God was fighting for them. God was fighting for Israel against Syria. And so we see this great victory that is going to be wrought against, again, in man's eyes, this superior force. But there's got to be some logical explanation. There's got to be some reasoning here behind this. And so the Syrians will report here, beginning in verse 23. The God of Israel, he's the God of the hills. And we lost because we fought him in the hills. That's the report that's going to go forth. And so if we back up a verse there in verse 22, God is going to warn Ahab, and he's going to tell him, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, will be back. He'll be back in a year. And that's exactly what's going to happen. Ben-Hadad's going to hear that the gods of Israel are the gods of the hills. And so maybe if we go and we fight them in the plains, then maybe we can win. And so they once again begin preparing. They build their army once again. Verse 26, it came to pass at the return of the year that Ben-Hadad numbered the Syrians and went up to Aphek to fight against Israel. And the children of Israel were numbered, were all present, went out against them. The children of Israel pitched before them like two little flocks of kids, but the Syrians filled the country. Again, Israel's outnumbered. Israel's outmatched. There's no way that they ought to be able to win this battle. But verse 28, there came a man of God and spoke unto the king of Israel and said, Thus saith the Lord, because the Syrians have said, The Lord is a God of the hills, but he is not a God of the valleys. Therefore will I deliver all this great multitude into thine hand, and you shall know that I am the Lord. You see, God's going to defend his honor. And yes, he's even going to defend his people. Now, Ahab was a wicked king, and Ahab did many wicked things. But God was going to show Ahab who he was, and God was going to show these heathen people who he was as well. They're going to know there is a God of Israel, and he's not just the God of the hills, and he's not just the God of the plains. He is the God of all. And so even once again, he's going to show a great victory. And I thought of that statement. Two main times come to my mind, but how often do we see that kind of statement? That idea, you shall know that I am the Lord. Go back and see how many times you see it within the book of Exodus. I begin writing down just a few verse references here, skimming through that word search of Exodus, and you could turn to Exodus 6 and verse 7, Exodus 7 and verse 5, Exodus 7 and verse 17, Exodus 8 and verse 22, Exodus 9 and verse 29, Exodus 14 and verse 18, Exodus 16 and verse 12, Exodus 29 and verse 46. And again, those are just a sampling, but look through the book of Exodus and see, underline, mark, highlight, how many times you see that idea, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Moses is going to know that he is the Lord. Pharaoh is going to know that he is the Lord. Israel is going to know he is the Lord. All of Egypt is going to know that he is the Lord. He's going to show himself by the great things that he would accomplish. I think there even of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 2 and verse 5, it was the idea, you shall know, or they shall know, there was a prophet of God among them. They're going to be able to look and see, yes, here was one that was speaking truth. And so, not just here in those particular verses, but indeed many times throughout the Bible, we see that idea expressed by the things that I do. They shall know there is a God in heaven who reigns. Isn't that what Ahab is going to get to see here? Isn't that what Ben-Hadad is going to get to see here as he's defeated? Yes, there is an all-powerful God in heaven. You shall know. That's the powerful message that I see time and again here in this 20th chapter of 1 Kings, that you can be assured there is a God in heaven, and he was going to come and he was going to fight for Israel. And so once again, there is a great victory here because the Lord was fighting for them. Verse 29, the battle was joined. The children of Israel slew of the Syrians 100,000 footmen in one day. The rest fled unto Aphek, unto the city, and there a wall fell upon 27,000 of the men that were left. And Ben-Hadad fled and came into the city into an inner chamber. You see a great defeat again for the Syrians, even though they well outnumbered Israel. And so we see those great victories, and yet sadly we end this chapter on a down note, because now we're going to see the foolishness once again of Ahab. Here is the enemy of God. Here is the enemy that now has raised himself against you as the king, but he has raised himself against your God. And your God has fought for you. And yet Ben-Hadad sends unto Ahab, and he's basically going to ask for forgiveness, if you will. Beginning in verse 31, his servants, that is Ben-Hadad's, would say unto him, "Behold now, we have heard that the kings of the house of Israel are merciful kings. Let us, I pray thee, put sackcloth on our loins and ropes upon our heads, and go out to the king of Israel. Peradventure he will save thy life." And so they go unto Ahab, and they would say unto him, "Thy servant Ben-Hadad saith, I pray thee, let me live." And he said, "Is he yet alive? He is my brother." Now the men did diligently observe whether anything would come from him, and they did hastily catch it. And they said, "Thy brother Ben-Hadad." And he said, "Go ye, bring him." Ben-Hadad came forth to him, and caused him to ride or come up into the chariot. Ben-Hadad said unto him, "The cities which my father took from thy father I will restore, and thou shalt make streets for thee in Damascus, as my father made in Samaria." And then said Ahab, "I will send thee away with this covenant." So he made a covenant with him and sent him away. God has fought for you. God has delivered this enemy into your hands. This is one who has fought against God and against his people, and Ahab quickly makes peace with him, and God will rebuke him in verse 35 and following. Yes, the foolishness of Ahab. And so the prophet of God once again comes, and he's going to remind him through this visual application, "You have not done that which was right." And so, verse 42, he said unto him, "Thus saith the Lord, because thou hast let go out of thy hand a man whom I appointed unto utter destruction, therefore thy life shall go for his life, and thy people for his people." There's going to be a consequence. And the Lord of his, and the king of Israel went to his house heavy and displeased, and came to Samaria. And so we see the foolishness of Ahab. In chapter 21, we once again are going to witness both the wickedness of Ahab, but maybe even greater than that, we're also going to see the wickedness of his wife Jezebel. In verse 1 through 4 of chapter 21, we're going to see an honorable Naboth and childish Ahab. It came to pass after these things that, verse 1, after these things that Naboth the Jezreelite had a vineyard, which was in Jezreel, hard by the palace of Ahab, king of Samaria. And Ahab spoke unto Naboth, saying, "Give me thy vineyard, that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it is near unto my house, and I will give thee for it a better vineyard than it, or if it seem good to thee, I will give thee the worth of it in money." And Naboth said to Ahab, "The Lord forbid it me, that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee." And Ahab came into his house heavy and displeased because of the words which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him. For he said, "I will not give thee the inheritance of my fathers." And he laid him down upon his bed, turned away his face, and would eat no bread. What an account that is before us. Ahab goes home, and he sees this vineyard. Basically, he says, like a kid, "I want it. I see it. It pleases me. I want it." And so he asks Naboth, "Will you give it to me?" I'll give you a better vineyard if you give me that one that's next to my house. Or I'll give you money that I might buy that vineyard of you. Now, Naboth is honorable. This is part of the inheritance that's supposed to pass down through my family, through my lineage. I can't give that away. And so he refuses the king's offer. He has acted honorable, and yet along comes Ahab, and he's going to act like a child. He goes home, and he throws a hissy fit. He's going to throw himself down upon his bed. He's going to moan and whine and complain and refuse to eat, just like a child that doesn't get their way. Well, Jezebel comes home. And Jezebel, verse 5 through verse 14, is going to act deceitfully. She's going to ask, what's wrong? What is this that has you so upset? Are you not the king of Israel? Can't you do what you want, what pleases you? He says, I want that field. I want that vineyard of Naboth, and he won't give it to me. Jezebel tells him, don't worry about it. Verse 7. You arise, you be merry. Don't worry about it. I'll tend to this, and the vineyard will be yours. Jezebel sets her wicked plan into action in verse 8. She writes letters in Ahab's name and seals them with his signet ring. She's going to send and have this great feast. And while at that great feast, she's going to have men that are paid, wicked men, to come and give false testimony against Naboth, that he is taken out of the city and that he is stoned. And then she'll go back unto Ahab, and she will report unto him, don't worry anymore. Naboth is dead. And so she goes unto Ahab and tells him, verse 15, arise and take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give thee for money, for Naboth is not alive, but dead. There's Jezebel's way of dealing with things. He wouldn't give it to you, and you wanted it? Kill him. Remove him. And now he's not an obstacle to you anymore. We see the hardness of her heart, and once again we see that great wickedness. I think we also need to point out in there the wickedness of men who, instead of being like the apostles and say we ought to obey God rather than man, would cower at the hand of Jezebel and go through with the wicked actions that she has proposed. They have killed an innocent man. There were those who would give false witness against an innocent man and would surely give an account for those things that they had done as well. Doesn't matter what orders we might receive of a king, we need to first and foremost follow God. And so we find verse 15 through verse 24, joy. First we see a joy. Ahab is going to go down into Naboth's vineyard to receive it unto himself. But his joy is quickly going to turn to sorrow and destruction. Because while he goes down to take possession of the vineyard, verse 17, the word of the Lord is going to come unto Elijah, saying, go down into that vineyard and meet Ahab, because he's gone to take possession of it. Verse 19, thus say to him, thus saith the Lord, hast thou killed and also taken possession? Thou shalt speak unto him, saying, thus saith the Lord, in the place where dogs lick the blood of Naboth, shall dogs lick thy blood, even thine. Ahab said unto Elijah, hast thou found me, O my enemy? And he answered, I have found thee, because thou hast sold thyself to work evil in the sight of the Lord. Naboth was complicit. excuse me, Ahab was complicit in this wickedness of Jezebel. And he's going to pay for his sins, even as Jezebel will also pay for her sins. And even though Ahab thinks that Elijah is his enemy, it's only so because Ahab has set himself against God. One of the things I think we can be reminded of there, Numbers 32 and verse 23, "Behold, thy sin shall find thee out." There was nothing that Ahab was doing that was hidden from the eyes of God. And Elijah is sent to Ahab to remind him, you are going to pay for your wickedness. And so those verses following, verse 21 through verse 24, are going to speak of the destruction that's going to come to Ahab, the destruction that's going to come to Ahab's family, and even the destruction that is going to come to Jezebel. And so those things are going to happen. They are going to be cast down. Their lineage is going to be destroyed. And that which they have caused to come upon Naboth and others will come upon them. We see that even there in verse 24. Him that dieth of Ahab in the city, the dog shall eat. Him that dieth in the field, the fowls of the air shall eat. Yes, there's a destruction, a payment that is coming. We look as you continue in that chapter then, look at verse 25 and verse 26, and simply titled that a sad epitaph, because it says, "There was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel his wife stirred up. And he did very abominably in following idols according to all things, as did the Amorites, whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel." What a sad epitaph to one's life. What can be said of Ahab? There was none like him. You know, that epitaph can be used in a good sense. There was none like him. If we're speaking of one of humility, of godliness, faithfulness, oh, there was none like him. But it said of Ahab concerning his wickedness. And as if he was not wicked enough, it speaks of Jezebel, his wife, who stirred or incited even more wickedness in him. And so there was a great legacy that he left, but it was a great negative legacy that he left. And you look here and you see, why did God drive out the wicked nations before you? It wasn't so that you could become just as wicked as they were. And yet that is exactly what Ahab has done. And what a horrible picture here has been painted for us of Ahab and Jezebel. And yet, look at the light that comes at the end of this chapter. After that sad epitaph of Ahab's life, we see a wonderful picture of the mercy of God. In verse 27 through verse 29, "And it came to pass, when Ahab heard these words, that he rent his clothes, put sackcloth upon his flesh, and fasted, and lay in sackcloth, and went softly. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, Seest thou how Ahab humbleth himself before me? Because he humbleth himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days will I bring the evil upon his house." God's already made pronouncement. Yes, this wickedness, this destruction, not wickedness, this rightful destruction is going to come upon Ahab and upon his house. But God is able to see within him. Here's a man at least that humbled himself when he heard the word of the Lord. Ahab didn't always do that. He didn't always choose that which was right and that which was good, but here on this occasion he did humble himself. And so God was willing to show his great mercy. And he says, I won't bring that destruction now in your life, but that destruction will follow after you. I see within that the ideas even of 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 4, speaking of God. And it says, who will have all men to be saved and to come unto the knowledge of the truth? You see, God didn't desire the destruction of anyone. What did he long for? What did he hope for? But that there would be those who would come to know of him, humble themselves before him, and to follow him. What did he want for Ahab? That Ahab would come into a knowledge of the truth and follow him. And he was willing to show mercy. He was willing to show even a great long-suffering nature. That nature that Peter is going to remind us of, even in 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9, he says, yes, there's a great destruction that's coming, regardless of what men say, because the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men count slackness, verse 9. But he is long-suffering to usward, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance, because he saw the humbleness of Ahab's heart. Now, I don't see a great repentance, and we're going to see here in just a moment that there's not a great change in his life. But there is at least that glimmer of hope, and God would show his mercy upon the life of Ahab, that he would not see this great destruction come in his family. And so I see the mercy, the tenderness, even the long-suffering nature of God. If any of us would humble ourselves to him, is he not also ready and willing to receive us and to show great mercy, even forgiveness unto us? Now, sadly, I wish there were some good notes that we could end there in Ahab's life. That maybe is the highlight of his life. The very fact that here on this one occasion he was willing to humble himself before God. But chapter 22 is going to remind us it didn't seem to last long. It wasn't a life-changing event for Ahab, in which he finally repented of his sins and decided to follow after God. Instead, it was a momentary blip on an otherwise wicked life. As you move into chapter 22, in verse 1 through 5, we find a proposal of war. Beginning in verse 1 of chapter 22, and they continued 3 years without war between Syria and Israel. And it came to pass in the third year that Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, came down to the king of Israel. And the king of Israel said unto his servants, Know ye that Ramoth and Gilead is ours? And we be still. We have withheld ourselves from taking it. And we take it not out of the hand of the king of Syria. And he said unto Jehoshaphat, Wilt thou go with me to battle to Ramoth-Gilead? And Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, I am as thou art, my people as thy people, my horses as thy horses. And Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, Inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today. There's an interesting occasion here. Now, the king of Israel, the king of Judah have come together. Jehoshaphat is king of Judah. Ahab is king of Israel. Ahab is speaking of this city that they still have not taken possession of back from the Syrians. And he is proposing, let us go to war, and we will war against the Syrians and take our city back. And he asks Jehoshaphat, will you go with me? Jehoshaphat seems quite willing and ready to go. He basically has already given his consent, but yet he does ask that Ahab inquire of the Lord. It's an interesting statement to me, not just because of Jehoshaphat's willingness to go into battle with Ahab. But the very idea that he's going to ask Ahab, a king that was known for his wickedness and his godlessness, to seek after the Lord, to ask what his opinion is. Why has not Jehoshaphat inquired after the Lord? But he has left this in the hand of Ahab. I also see within this, as we study through this chapter, that foolishness. You know, Ahab has been extended this mercy of God at the end of chapter 21. And now in chapter 20, Ahab seemingly has once again steeled himself really against listening to God. He's not that interested in hearing what the true prophets of God have to say, and he's not going to be willing any longer to really humble himself unto what they would advise. He's going to go and he's going to do his own thing, and that certainly seems to have already been settled in his mind. That's what I want to do. That's what I'm going to do, regardless of what others will say. But as we continue, I also want to point out here a foolishness of those who surrounded Ahab. We're going to see two very different types of men. We're going to see men pleasers, and we're going to see those who would seek to please God. And that's a question we're going to have to ask ourselves in our lives. Am I a man pleaser? I want to please those that are around me, or am I ultimately going to please God? And so it says in verse 6, the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said unto them, "Shall I go against Ramoth-Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And they said, "Go up, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king." Now, these prophets are not identified for us. It certainly doesn't seem they have inquired of God. It just in general says he gathered together the prophets. Maybe he has gathered together those men that will tell him that which he wants to hear, because Jehoshaphat's going to speak up in verse 7 and say, "Is there not here a prophet of the Lord besides?" You've gathered your prophets. Well, what about a prophet of the Lord that we might inquire of him? And Ahab, verse 8, will say, "There is yet one man, Micaiah, that we might inquire of the Lord, but I hate him, for he doeth not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. I don't like what he has to say." Probably because he speaks the word of God. And so the king of Israel will call for Micaiah. And as they are waiting on him, verse 10, Jehoshaphat, Ahab are sitting on their thrones. They have their robes, and there are going to be prophets. There is Zedekiah that is going to come in verse 11, and he is going to make horns of iron. And he's going to say, "Thus saith the Lord, with these shalt thou push the Syrians until thou have consumed them." And all the prophets prophesied so, saying, "Go up to Ramoth-Gilead, prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the king's hand." All of these men are telling the king exactly what he wants to hear. But notice here, verse 13, as Micaiah is called, they tell him, "Speak good unto the king." All the prophets are telling him to go up and to prosper. And so when you come before the king, you make sure your word matches that which they are saying. Go and speak good to the king. And we, once again, you need to highlight, underline, circle, mark, take note of verse 14, because this is the type of people we need to be. As Micaiah will say, "As the Lord liveth, what the Lord saith unto me, that will I speak." I'm going to be true to God. I'm going to be God's man. You see, I'm not going to tell people that which they want to hear. I'm not going to be an ear tickler. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 4. You see, Paul told Timothy, you preach the word in verse 2. Men are going to be turned into fable. They're going to be seeking after those who will speak unto them those things that are smooth and those things that they want to hear. But you preach the word of the Lord. Paul in his own life would speak of this in Galatians chapter 1 and in verse 10. He would say, for do I now persuade men or God? Or do I seek to please men? For if I yet pleased men, I should not be the servant of Christ. You see, we can't do both. We can't speak that which men want to hear and be men pleasers, and yet at the same time speak that which God says needs to be said. Now, we're going to have to decide. I'm going to stand with God, and I'm going to speak His word. And that's what Micaiah was ready to do. Now, he does it in an interesting way. Here, Micaiah is going to come before the king, and he's going to say, go, prosper, for the Lord shall deliver it into the hand of the king. It seems interesting what Micaiah has to say, but I think we can tell by the response. The king knows Micaiah is speaking craftily. Verse 16, the king would say, how many times shall I adjure thee that thou tell me nothing but that which is true in the name of the Lord? What are you really saying? And Micaiah is going to go on to tell him again of this account. Verse 17, he said, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as a sheep that have not a shepherd. And the Lord said, these have no master, let them return every man to his house. That's what's going to happen. Yes, someone's going to prosper, but it's not going to be Israel. They're going to be left without a shepherd, without a king. Ahab, you'll lose your life in battle. Of course, that's not what Ahab wants to hear. Verse 18, he's going to turn Jehoshaphat and say, didn't I tell you he always prophesies evil against me and not good? But Micaiah goes on and he's going to tell of this idea where there was a lying spirit that was willing to go forth, and that's how Ahab was going to be deceived. And that lying spirit has appeared in all of these prophets because they're telling you that which you want to hear. Zedekiah will have, or will go forth and slap Micaiah on the cheek, verse 24, and mock him. And yet, verse 25, Micaiah will say, behold, thou shalt see in that day when thou shalt go into an inner chamber to hide thyself. You see, he's saying, you're going to know. There's coming a day in which you're going to know who was speaking that which was true. Was it these false prophets? Was it what you were telling the king? Or was it what Micaiah was saying by the mouth of the Lord? The king will have Micaiah taken and restrained, verse 27, until he says, you restrain him until I come in peace. And yet, verse 28, Micaiah says, if thou return at all in peace, the Lord hath not spoken by me. Does that not remind you of Deuteronomy chapter 18? How do you tell the true prophet of God? Does the things that he says come to pass? And Micaiah says, you're going to see. You're not coming again in peace. And then everyone's going to know that Micaiah was speaking the word of the Lord and not these false prophets. And yet, even at that, Ahab and Jehoshaphat are going to join together and go up into war. And even though Ahab will hide himself so that he will disguise himself in verse 30, nevertheless, he will die in battle, verse 34. They recognize that the king has disguised himself. One will draw his bow, and that arrow will find itself, and it will kill Ahab. It will fatally wound him, and he will die that very night. And you go back, and you see, as they bring him back to Samaria, they will bury him there, verse 37, and they wash the blood out of the chariot in the pool of Samaria, and the dogs licked up his blood. You begin to see the fulfillment of that which Elijah had said. Now, the rest of the acts of Ahab, verse 39, all that he did, and the ivory house which he made, and all the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? Ahab slept with his fathers, and Ahaziah his son reigned in his stead. And so, there we have the sad and rebellious life of Ahab. One little blip of some good as he humbles himself there at the end of chapter 21. But even the great mercy of God did not make a great impact on the life of Ahab. As you continue, even there, you begin to have a little more history that's going to be revealed to us in the end of this chapter. It tells us a little bit about Jehoshaphat, one who in some ways has a bit of a mixed epitaph. This isn't a good record of him here in chapter 22 as he aligns himself with Ahab, and yet for the most part, he lived a good life. Verse 43, he walked in all the ways of Asa his father. He turned not aside from it, doing that which was right in the eyes of the Lord. Nevertheless, oh, how that it could be said of us, we did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord, but I hope it's not followed up with nevertheless. Because here he says, nevertheless, the high places were not taken away, for the people offered and burned incense yet in the high places. We have this account of chapter 22 where it seems he stood in rebellion, even as the prophet of God said, there's destruction, there's loss that's going to come. Verse 44, and he made peace with the king of Israel. It didn't seem to line up with that good life. I hope we don't have that mixed epitaph. Let's strive to be those who can be said, we did that which was right in the eyes of the Lord. And then I want to close. Again, some history is given to us there, but I want to close here at the end of this chapter in verse 51 through verse 53 and see this sad legacy that Ahab left behind. It says, Ahaziah, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel and Samaria, the 17th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and reigned 2 years over Israel. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, and walked in the way of his father, and in the way of his mother, the way of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. For he served Baal, and worshipped him, and provoked the Lord to anger, according to all that his father had done. You see, here his son, Ahaziah, has now become just like Ahab. You've had the wickedness that he has built up. Is it any surprise that his son then would follow after that legacy? Friends, I hope we're asking ourselves, not just how am I living this life, knowing 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, one day I'll stand before that judgment seat of Christ, give an answer to those things that I've done in the body, whether it be good or bad. Yes, I need to pay attention to my life for that reason, but I also need to pay attention to my life for the very reason I'm leaving a legacy, that others are watching after me, and they may well follow in my footsteps. Are my children, are my neighbors, are my family, are my friends going to see an example that leads them closer to God or that will lead them further away from God? Friends, that's the choice we make in our lives. What will your answer be? I hope it's not to live like the life of Ahab. And so with that account, we draw to the close of what we know of as the book of 1 Kings. And I hope you'll join us again tomorrow morning as once again we open the pages of God's Word here at 9 a.m. Central Standard Time for Mornings for the Master and begin to look into the book of 2 Kings. And so I hope that you'll be with us, continuing even today, listening right here on the Gospel Radio Network. And we hope that you have a great day.